Stress creates inflammation, creates atherosclerosis, creates CHD. If the first link in this chain of events is instead self-awareness, the rest of the sequence is either preventable or reduced, making treatment easier. Earlier, we gave some pointers on how to remain self-aware at work. But self-awareness can be blocked by all kinds of things. Using the workplace as an example, the pressure of deadlines induces a level of stress that's chronic, and we adapt to it by blocking it out, eventually even normalizing it. But our cells don't have this blocking mechanism and incrementally become damaged. Heart rate variability suffers under the constant demands of a typical workday. The sedentary routine of modern jobs, many of which involve hours at the computer, weakens muscle tone and adds to the current epidemic of obesity. The repetition involved in routine work dulls the mind and creates a flattened mood. Interpersonal tensions in the workplace create resentment, anger, envy, and anxiety that wind up being shoved down out of sight without actually being resolved. Unexpressed negative emotions and tension are communicated back and forth between the brain, heart, and gut along the vagus nerve, creating diminished function that often shows up in a tight stomach, an irritated bowel, constipation, and other signs of inflammation. These workplace stressors offer a prime example of how normal life is actually working against healing, and similar stressors exist outside the workplace, at home. However, no matter how slow the pace of dysfunction is, the whole system is paying a steady price that mounts up bit by bit every day. When you go to work, you are taking 50 trillion cells to the office with you, and their well-being determines your well-being in the end. Inflammation is a complex issue that largely occurs at a hidden cellular level. But the stress response is something we can control in everyday life. Ironically, this is the element most people pay the least attention to. They improve their lifestyle with diet and exercise, while leading fast-paced, demanding lives that lie at the heart of the problem. The next step in our healing journey is to look at how stress and the healing response are connected at the deepest level. 5. Getting out of overdrive. Decades after stress became a household word, most people don't understand it. And that's not their fault. Ask yourself which of the following events you would consider stressful. Going through a divorce? Winning the lottery? Going on vacation? Having a baby? The correct answer is all of the above. Stress can be defined as any input that triggers the body's stress response. Psychologically, stress results whenever anxiety about the future or regrets about the past are invoked. We may label a nasty divorce as a negative event, and winning the lottery as a positive one, but that's not how the lower brain sees it. The lower, or reptilian brain, is an evolutionary inheritance from earlier stages of life on Earth, bringing with it our ancestral fight or flight response. A vast range of everyday experiences, from giving birth to losing your job, from having depression in your family history to breaking the bank at Las Vegas, can be stressful. Experts refer to eustress, indicating that the stressor is a happy event. The Greek prefix eu means good or well, but it is stressful nonetheless. In a healing lifestyle, we must address the stress that accumulates over time. And because most of this accumulation is invisible and occurs very slowly, there is really no difference between stress management and life management. For example, joyous as it is to give birth, new mothers report that raising an infant is extremely stressful. Not that this should come as a surprise. We adapt to eustress and distress, the good and bad along the spectrum, because we must. Babies need to be cherished and nurtured, despite the cost in both physical and mental stress to the parents. A whole system approach tells us that putting up with stress isn't good enough. New parents are assured by everyone who has been there that babies eventually stop waking you up in the middle of the night, stop teething, stop being terrible two-year-olds. All true. But there is always something stressful lying ahead, which is true of life in general. So, dealing with stress involves two things. Clearing from the system the residue of old stressors, and preventing the impact of new stressors from being too severe. Both steps figure prominently in life management. Handling acute stress. Some events strike out of the blue and face us with immediate stress. These are known as acute stresses. Being fired is an example. And all of us have experienced how difficult losing a job can be. It's something deeply feared by millions of people. We have also experienced self-defeating ways of dealing with this kind of crisis. A certain percentage of people simply withdraw and seek distraction, hoping that time will heal their wound. Psychiatric studies have found, for example, that the most common behavior in the face of acute stress is watching more television, which now would be updated to constantly playing video games, a phenomenon that has become endemic among older blue-collar workers laid off from work, often permanently. Since this behavior is also attended by higher rates of opiate addiction among white males over 50, and an alarming increase in suicides, using distraction clearly isn't a viable defense against acute stress. In your own life, when you are hit by acute stress, such as a bad breakup or the diagnosis of a potentially serious disorder, a certain amount of withdrawal and distraction is natural and good. Time doesn't lead to complete healing, but it allows disrupted emotions to return to equilibrium. Turning to comfort food and eating your feelings makes sense emotionally for a while, but eventually you need to cope with acute stress in a healing way that is proactive. Otherwise, you may walk away with lasting wounds, bad memories, lower self-esteem, and other damage. The path to healing is actually demonstrated by the situation of having a baby. After the mother gives birth, her brain creates higher levels of dopamine and oxytocin, two chemicals associated with heightened mood, even euphoria. As with any pleasure or reward a person experiences, the first time makes us want it again. A 2008 study headed by Lane Strathern at Baylor University and published in the journal Pediatrics showed that when new mothers experienced pleasure upon seeing their baby, the same brain regions were activated as those activated by cocaine, in this case a natural high. Intriguingly, seeing either a happy or sad baby face was pleasurable, as measured by reward signals in the mother's brain, as long as she felt confident and secure about her baby. In contrast, mothers who were overly stressed about their newborns had different areas of the brain activated when the baby cried, areas linked to pain and disgust. It turns out that the stress level of a mother can have a dramatic effect on her interaction with the infant and how the baby's own brain will develop. The stress that occurs when a newborn arrives isn't simply going to vanish. For a year or more, both parents live disrupted lives, and the typical signs of acute stress rise up to greet them, including fatigue, frayed tempers, bad sleep, and a sense of losing control. Stress experts indicate that increasing the unpredictability in your life and feeling that you are out of control makes acute stress much worse. It's easy to see how losing your job turns a steady income and pride in doing a good job into the opposite, having no accomplishment to feel proud of and not knowing what the future will bring. But having a baby has the same dimensions. Infant health is unpredictable, and parents have no control over when their baby is suddenly going to need immediate attention. Some parents of newborns do much better at coping than others. Here are examples of how they do it. The baby solution to acute stress. The key is a range of coping mechanisms anyone can call upon. Get enough rest and sleep. Make time for yourself every day to be alone and quiet. Make sure you get outside to refresh your connection to nature. Maintain an active life. Don't be chained to the situation. Share duties and responsibilities. Ask for help before you feel overwhelmed. Pursue a regular routine. This helps offset unpredictable events. Find an activity that makes you feel in control. Find a confidant with whom you can share your feelings without judgment. Don't martyr yourself by taking on more than you can handle. Fight the urge to feel victimized. Don't isolate yourself. Keep up your social activity. Seek out people in the same situation who can empathize with you and offer positive support. Resist self-judgment. Be easy on yourself, accepting the ups and downs of emotions as natural. Where there is the possibility of finding joy, pause to appreciate it. The arrival of a baby is such a joyful event that the positive side that counters the stress is obvious and easily accessible. The same isn't true if you're going through a divorce or suddenly lose your job. Even so, the important point is to be aware that you can cope by developing the coping behavior we've outlined. This is a conscious, self-aware project. Your built-in responses can't accomplish it for you. If you find yourself in a crisis that induces acute stress, take the following steps. 1. Start a journal about your path out of the crisis. 2. In your journal, write down the list of coping mechanisms we've just given. You might want to make each one a page heading on its own. 3. Under each coping behavior, write down something you can do immediately to adopt that behavior. 4. Follow up every day with your successes when a coping mechanism is beginning to work for you. None of these coping mechanisms is complicated. Most are self-explanatory. But acute stress is such a powerful disruption that it throws our awareness off kilter. We wind up doing things we know deep down are self-defeating, such as being alone too much of the time, acting out the role of a victim, and letting fear and anxiety gain the upper hand by keeping our emotions bottled up. We've already described how people who feel supported are significantly less likely to develop angina than those who don't feel such support. The connection between emotional well-being and heart health is undeniable. But the same truth holds for confronting acute stress, which threatens health and well-being at every level, including your body. Yet in most lives, situations that create acute stress will tend to be intermittent and hopefully rare. We need to extend the discussion to the invisible kind of everyday stress that actually causes more harm than people realize. Harm that can prove disastrous over a period of years without being detected. We're referring to the hidden culprit, chronic stress. Chronic stress and sympathetic overdrive. How are you handling the little everyday stresses in your life? Most people complain about the stressors that plague almost everyone in modern society, particularly its high speed, long work hours, and inescapable irritations like traffic jams and boring commutes. Our inclination is to adapt to these stresses, taking them in stride. We shrug off the way life keeps speeding up, even demanding more speed when it comes to the internet and smartphones. We listen to music to divert the frustration of traffic snarls and long waits at the airport. We accept that work pressures are necessary in order to get ahead in our careers. Human adaptation is a miracle. But stress management took a wrong turn at the outset when experts and the medical profession in general focused on two factors as the most important: physical stress and outside stress. These go hand in hand. The theory was that some external event triggered a physical response in the body. And in this interaction, the main problem of stress was revealed. So if you hear gunfire, outside stressor, and instantly feel your pulse racing, physical response, the typical stress reaction has been triggered. True, this pattern is common enough. We mentioned earlier a string of outside events that are highly stressful, such as going through a divorce or winning the lottery. But from a whole system viewpoint, at least half the story is untold, because the inner world of subjective events creates stress, too, and at the same time is the source for healing the effects of stress. Let's look at a highly stressful event: entering the hospital for surgery. On the physical side, the stressful event is the medical procedure itself, but other stresses are having an impact mentally and emotionally. These include the following: worrying about the surgery's outcome, high or low expectations, trust or distrust in medical care, the strangeness of the hospital environment, disruption to normal daily habits, intrusive and embarrassing poking and prodding, loss of control over what is happening, anxiety about the future, fear of what will happen to the whole family. So much depends on these factors that they should be placed first and foremost. To a surgeon, either he successfully repairs a diseased heart, liver, or brain, or he doesn't. But the physical outcome barely touches upon the invisible stresses and how we handle them. Because the inner approach to stress, including meditation and mindfulness practices, has proved to be so beneficial in reducing stress, it's reasonable to think that going inward is how the average person fights against stress. But it would be an exaggeration to believe that meditation and mindfulness have penetrated deeply into typical Western lifestyles. Why? There has been plenty of media coverage about meditation and its benefits. The negative attitudes toward it have steadily melted away. Few people now consider meditation a strange, esoteric, religious practice from the East. The resistance to adopting meditation and mindfulness gives us a portrait of life that is stuck in old habits and attitudes that not only block meditation, but also block a healing lifestyle generally. Without seeing the damage we are doing, most of us, the vast majority in fact, have put ourselves in overdrive. What does this mean? In physiological terms, the best reference is the nervous system. The nervous system is the prime example of how your body operates under dual control, a point we keep returning to. Any process that you don't have to think about is handled by the autonomic nervous system, which in lay terms was once referred to, somewhat mistakenly, as the involuntary nervous system. Essentially, the autonomic nervous system controls how organs function. The term involuntary once made perfect sense. Because the nerves that control the heart, stomach, and digestive tract oversee functions that don't need our voluntary cooperation. You can't tell your heart to stop beating or your small intestine to give you a break and extract fewer calories from the food you eat. But the idea that you have no control over the autonomic system is misleading. Because this nervous system turns out to be more adaptable to our wishes, feelings, thoughts, and other mental activity than anyone used to think. The autonomic nervous system is divided into two parts, known as the sympathetic and parasympathetic nervous system. Again, the terms are a bit misleading, since sympathetic isn't being used in the same way as extending your sympathy to someone else. The basic function of the sympathetic nervous system is to deliver the fight or flight response. Even though the lower brain is the seat of fight or flight, it takes a whole network of nerves throughout the body, extending from the spinal cord, to activate everything that goes into this one response. A great many elements are involved in the fight or flight response. Pupil dilation, increased sweating, increased heart rate, and increased blood pressure. At the same time, digestion is temporarily halted, metabolism shifts into another gear, and muscles begin to operate anaerobically, that is, without needing oxygen. Being temporary, these are emergency measures only. Evolution didn't equip us to react to stress constantly. In addition, when a full-blown stress response is triggered, there is little one can do to override it because the hormones being secreted, such as cortisol and adrenaline, latch onto specific receptors in the cell membrane and trigger a chain of unstoppable events inside the cell. For example, in bone marrow, chronic stress can cause immune cells to promote inflammation, a process that begins with changes at the level of genes. If a certain stressor, like a loud neighbor, is happening every day, chronic inflammation can be the result leading to heart disease, cancer, or other disorders. Luckily, these detrimental changes in our cells in response to stress can also be temporary. From this picture, instead of saying that most people are in overdrive, what we should call it is sympathetic overdrive, because too much demand is being placed on the sympathetic nervous system. Fight or flight feels like an on-off mechanism when you experience it. The signs are drastic and unmistakable. If you've ever seen street magic on TV, or in person, when the magician performs a trick, whether it's pulling the ace of spades from behind someone's ear or correctly reading a random number they are thinking, many spectators actually run away. They may be laughing, but the sympathetic nervous system can't take a joke and forces them to flee, at least for a moment. Yet in reality, the stress response operates on a sliding scale, and the sympathetic nervous system can be thrown into a low-level state that over time produces a wide range of damaging effects. Beyond what most people realize, being in sympathetic overdrive undermines them every day. We can illustrate the problem with a story about a woman we'll call Mara, whose life contains nothing disastrous or deeply troubling, but who exemplifies how far from healing many people actually are without knowing it. Mara's story. Invisible damage over time. Mara is 40, successful, and has little to complain about. She learned early on that she was a bright student, and academic achievement followed her through school until she graduated with honors from an Ivy League college. This was in the mid-1990s. And like many other young people buoyed by a booming economy, she went into the financial sector, getting a good entry job at a major bank. Her life began to unfold according to plan. "I made very good money, and I got promoted on the fast track," Mara recalls. "The price was total dedication to the job, and like everyone I knew, I spent a minimum of 60 hours at work every week. I took work home and sometimes came into the office on Saturdays. Frankly, I enjoyed it. When I heard that some people thrive on stress, I thought to myself, this is me. Mara developed this attitude after discovering very quickly how competitive her chosen career actually was. Her friendship soon became limited to co-workers at the bank, young, ambitious types she found exciting to be around. They were determined to be winners. Out of this pool of people, she began to date Frank, another banker, who was also attending law school at night. Frank was driven, Mara says. But he was also smart and funny. He could size people up and cut them down to size if he had to. It seemed like we made a great team. With matching lifestyles and goals, they became a serious couple and moved in together. With such a strong focus on work, they decided to postpone having a baby at least until their 30s. Fast forward 5 years. At 30, Mara had moved on to a new relationship. Looking back at the 3 years she spent with Frank, they were probably too much alike. They both had strong egos, they argued a lot, and neither liked to back down. Yet what finally broke up the relationship was money. When Mara began to make more than Frank did, he sulked and tried to compensate by trying to act more dominant and aggressive, looking for excuses to put her down. I wasn't that shaken up when he decided to move out, says Mara. I suspected he was looking around for somebody else anyway. I bounced back pretty quickly, and it was only a few months later that I met Jason, who wasn't ambitious and had a career totally outside finance. Jason is tender, caring, and non-competitive, where Frank was self-centered, tense, and angry. Once I saw the contrast, it was easy to make a change. Mara's career was still moving ahead, but she did notice that males at her level were getting promoted ahead of her. This and other evidence of sexism made work more problematic, but she was good at her job. She also started paying attention to exercise. She jogged regularly now, and watching her weight, two things that hadn't really been part of her lifestyle in her 20s. Jump ahead to age 40. Mara married Jason, and they have a 4-year-old girl. After taking 3 months of maternity leave when the baby was born, Mara was back at work. She feels good about her relationship with Jason, but there are areas of conflict. In particular, he revealed himself to be passive and sometimes does things she considers passive-aggressive, like forgetting to pick their child up from daycare on the day after a big fight with Mara. In the dynamic of their marriage, Mara has adopted the aggressor role, although she hates being that way, while Jason goes quiet and watches TV if he senses tension, even though she's begged him 1,000 times to tell her how he really feels. I look around, and things aren't perfect, she says. I sort of fell into the supermom syndrome, trying to be a total achiever at work and a caring wife and mother at home. It's going okay. There are plenty of people worse off than me. There are other positive aspects of her life that she rarely even thinks about. Mara's health is good, essentially as worry-free as when she was 20. She's never had a cancer scare, and being premenopausal, her body's estrogen has protected her so far from heart disease. It's true that she stopped jogging during her pregnancy and never returned to it, and she intermittently attempts to diet to lose the 10 pounds she gained back then. But with increasing emotional maturity, she is better able to navigate the ups and downs of an intimate relationship, as well as raise a child like a responsible, loving parent. So where's the problem? Millions of people lead similar lives and feel that nothing troublesome is affecting them. Yet if you consider what we've discovered so far about a healing lifestyle, Mara isn't living it. Here's how to gain insight as to where the invisible cracks can occur in the life you are likely to be leading now. How a normal lifestyle blocks healing. Daily activity gets driven by work, with its demand for achievement and success, along with our fear of loss and failure. Self-esteem is built on external norms like getting promoted and being competitive. With so much focus on externals, life is lived on the surface. As the outside factors get more organized, a person's inner life doesn't keep up. Emotional needs are placed second or not faced honestly. Little or no attention is paid to chronic low-level stress. Relationships settle into routine and habit. Physical activity and contact with nature begin to diminish over time. Life becomes gradually more sedentary. There's no higher vision of possibilities, thanks to the burden of constant demands and duties from family and work. Paying attention to health issues is temporary and intermittent. For the most part, little is done until actual symptoms appear. This is a shocking list of things we take for granted or manage to put up with, even though they keep us in sympathetic overdrive. Stress follows in the wake of each item on the list, which means that stress is a much bigger issue than we assume. To put it simply, millions of people put a positive value on choices that are actually negative from a whole system perspective. So where do you stand right now? It's hard to assess your own stress simply because the body-mind system is so good at adapting. Years go by without seeming to expose the damage stress is doing. Stress experts recognize three stages of stress that occur one after the other. The earliest stage exposes psychological effects. The next stage, behavioral effects. And the third stage, physical effects. What follows is a summary of each. Consider each category to see if you detect any signs of stress taking its toll on you. Three levels of damage: psychological and neural. Psychological and neural damage begins with minor things like feeling mentally tired and under pressure from deadlines at work. When people say they are stressed out, they generally mean that they've run out of energy, which can mask mental states like being depressed, anxious, or even panicky. Because the brain is being affected, there's interruption in normal sleep rhythms or the nagging feeling that time is running out, a condition Dr. Larry Dossey dubbed time sickness. With mental fatigue can come flawed decision-making or memory lapses. But in general, the problem is loss of concentration, the ability to focus. Emotionally, stress seems to make us retreat to infancy, becoming prone to outbursts of anger, distress, and irritability. The more the stress mounts, the shorter the fuse gets on our negative emotions. Behavioral. Negative changes in behavior are likely to manifest in two major areas, work and relationships. Stressful jobs make us respond with all kinds of behaviors, from office gossip to going out for a drink after work. As stress mounts, the drinking can get heavier, the need for distraction more severe. Inevitably, we take our feelings home after work, where friction easily follows. A spouse who feels neglected, mistreated, or ignored is feeling the brunt of stress-related behavior. Stress makes one person lose his appetite and another overeat. Sleep often gets disrupted, and in some cases, chronic insomnia is the outcome. This and other ill effects might lead the person to become dependent on sleeping pills and other drugs in an attempt to shake off work stress and find the way back to feeling normal. Physical. When the body can't completely adapt to stress, bad effects follow without being predictable. Most people will suffer from physical fatigue, stomach aches, bad digestion, and headaches are likely. So is a reduced immune response, leading to more colds and worsened allergies. After that, the problems will tend to be associated with inflammation, whose effects can travel anywhere. One person may experience skin eruptions, another irritable bowel syndrome, yet another a heart attack or stroke. By this stage, the damage caused by stress has led to serious system breakdown. In the brain, stress activates a specific neural network called the hypothalamus-pituitary-adrenal, HPA, axis. Activation of the HPA axis leads to the excess production of specific hormones known as glucocorticoids by the adrenal glands. Glucocorticoids are needed for normal brain development and are also activated during moments of acute stress. However, elevated levels can have the reverse effect and cause neurotoxicity, as shown in studies of stress during pregnancy. There is a natural barrier that prevents stress hormones in the mother from being passed through the placenta to the fetus. In stressful pregnancy, this barrier appears to be crossed, and one major result is interference with normal brain development and functioning. When glucocorticoids were given to pregnant rats, the brains of the offspring didn't develop properly. Much more than was suspected in the past, a difficult pregnancy that puts the mother under chronic stress can have far-reaching effects at the cellular and genetic level. In humans, excess glucocorticoids in the prenatal brain of the fetus directly affect levels of dopamine, which, as we saw earlier, is involved in reward or pleasure-seeking. Prenatal stress may also have downstream effects as infants grow up, including learning disabilities, higher susceptibility to drug abuse, and increased anxiety and depression. Maternal stress has also been linked with increased HPA axis activity at different ages of the child, including at 6 months, 5 years, and 10 years, and onward to adulthood. Disturbingly, in animal studies, these elevated levels of glucocorticoids linger genetically into the next generation or two. We don't offer any of this information to alarm you, only to show that low-level stress deserves to be called the epidemic of civilization. With its tentacles reaching everywhere, no one is immune. The dilemma is that, being so pervasive, chronic stress causes too many things to potentially go wrong. Experts have found no single remedy that can cope with the unpredictable outcomes brought about by everyday stress. Let's see how a healing lifestyle can do better. The whole system answer. You won't be surprised that the whole system answer is to bring awareness into the picture. Since the first ill effects of chronic stress are psychological and neural, this is where healing also begins. We've already mentioned that putting up with stress and adapting yourself to it are bad strategies. Your cells aren't adapting even when you think you are. A good example would be workers on the night shift. Long stretches of night work disrupt the body's circadian or daily biorhythms. As a result, the most obvious detriment is the loss of good sleep, which has long been known. The brain never fully adjusts to a schedule of not sleeping at night. But further investigations have revealed that night shift workers are at risk in 7 other ways. Higher risk of diabetes. Increased likelihood of obesity because of hormonal imbalance affecting hunger and satiation. Increased risk of breast cancer. Negative metabolic changes that could influence heart disease risk. Potential increase in heart attacks. Higher likelihood of workplace accidents. Higher risk for depression. In short, the whole system is potentially affected due to putting too much disruption in a single biorhythm that turns out to be connected to other biorhythms, like the link between sleep and hunger satiation. It also seems that the obvious solution, quitting your night shift job, may not be enough to reverse the damage if someone has been working too many years at night. The basic lesson for everyone is that stressors aren't isolated things. A blanket behavior or attitude can spread its bad influence very widely. Let's say you're at the airport and find out that your flight has been canceled. The airline won't bring another airplane into service, but tells you that you must wait 5 hours until a flight arrives that can accommodate you. With no alternative except to comply with the airline's mistreatment, passengers look passive as they sit and wait. But on the inside, many people, perhaps you, will react with the following responses: worry, complaining, and pessimism. All are self-defeating. Worry is self-induced anxiety. It solves nothing and blocks the possibility of dealing with things more positively. Complaining increases tension and anger. As a display of hostility, it encourages other people to act hostile in return. Pessimism induces the illusion that a situation is hopeless. It fosters the belief that expecting a bad outcome is always realistic, when in fact it isn't. If you see yourself in any of these behaviors and attitudes, you are fooling yourself into believing that you are adapting to stress. As your body experiences it, however, you have become the stressor yourself. That's because an external event, canceled flight, must go through an internal interpretation before it triggers the stress response. Unlike a crisis like losing your job, a flight delay belongs in the category of everyday chronic stresses, which means that you have a choice to respond. Worry, complaining, and pessimism are unconscious responses. People who are stuck in them have become the victims of old reactions that became glued in place because the person didn't reevaluate them. Some people handle a canceled flight better than others. Just as we give you the baby solution for acute stress, here's the airport solution for low-level, everyday stress. The airport solution to chronic stress. Detach yourself from the stressor. At the airport, people do this by reading a book or finding a place to be alone. Become centered. At the airport, people do this when they shut their eyes to meditate. Remain active. At the airport, this means walking around instead of slumping in a chair and waiting. Seek positive outlets. At the airport, this might mean shopping, getting a chair massage, or going to a restaurant. Rely on emotional support. At the airport, the usual way to do this is by calling a friend or family member on the phone. A short call announcing that you'll be late won't give you emotional support. The key is a conversation with someone meaningful in your life that lasts at least half an hour. Escape if you must. At the airport, if the airline's behavior gets too outrageous, it saves your psychology to reschedule and go home. Of course, this is not always practical or affordable. All of these things are positive adaptations, as opposed to the negativity of worry, complaining, and pessimism. They bring awareness into a situation where falling back on passive acceptance isn't the right answer. Beneath the attitude of, "I have to put up with it," lies stress. A canceled flight is usually not fixable by you, and it can happen any time without warning. Therefore, it fits the two conditions that make stress worse: unpredictability and loss of control. You have the option of turning the situation around by interpreting it not as bad luck, but as a non-stress, to which you respond by doing things you actually want to do, like meditating, connecting with a friend, or shopping. When you become adept at this turnaround, chronic stress is nipped in the bud. You cut short a process that otherwise would have affected your body like Chinese water torture, drip by drip. The airport solution applies right now as well. It describes a strategy for getting yourself out of sympathetic overdrive. There's a physiological explanation for what happens. The sympathetic nervous system is balanced by an entirely separate set of nerves with opposing responses known as the parasympathetic nervous system. Instead of tension, it brings relaxation. As nature designed them, the sympathetic and parasympathetic nervous systems are antagonists, we can say. The temporary, drastic action of the sympathetic nervous system is countered by the continuous balancing activity of the parasympathetic nervous system. Under chronic stress, we ask the sympathetic nervous system to stay on guard all the time until it gets out of its normal groove and begins to impair the normal state of balance. At the same time, the relaxed normal state of the parasympathetic nervous system gets blocked or sidelined. To get out of overdrive, you must enhance the parasympathetic side of the equation. This can only be done by applying conscious choice, since left to its own devices, the two antagonists will keep doing what they are habituated to do. Absent the influence of stress, the automatic back and forth of sympathetic and parasympathetic takes care of itself. It is self-regulating. But stress is metaphorically like leaning on a wall until steady pressure makes it buckle. As applied to a healing lifestyle, the airport solution needs to be activated every day as follows. Detach yourself from the stressor. Make sure you have periods of downtime and alone time. Become centered. Practice meditation, the most desirable tactic, or at the very least find time throughout the day to shut your eyes in a quiet place and take some deep breaths until you feel relaxed and centered. The best breathing technique, which we mentioned in connection with the workplace, is to breathe in to a count of four, then breathe out to a count of six. Remain active. Getting up and moving around throughout the day stimulates the vagus nerve, one of the principal pathways of the autonomic nervous system. Yoga is even more stimulating and is the best activity for switching from sympathetic overdrive to heightened parasympathetic activity. Seek positive outlets. In this case, the word positive means anything that makes you happy. Making time to be happy is a whole system strategy, but that's dry and abstract. Happiness is the philosopher's stone for turning a stressful situation into a healing one. In psychological terms, this is why the best way to build a happy life is to build happy days. Rely on emotional support. Modern society is more and more isolating, which was true even before the internet and video games greatly accelerated the problem. There is no substitute for emotional bonding, and one thing almost always found in happiness studies is that the happiest people spend an hour or even more per day being in contact either personally or on the phone with friends and family who mean the most to them. Escape if you must. This is generally the hardest choice for most people, who will endure stressful situations long after it is evident that escaping and walking away is the right choice. Aggravated situations like domestic abuse are actually acute stressors. Significant life changes like divorce or switching careers must take many factors into account. However, on an everyday basis, you should give yourself the freedom to walk away from heated arguments, malicious gossip, rude emails, perpetual complainers, worry warts, and anyone who is openly criticizing you. In the end, getting out of sympathetic overdrive, which doesn't occur to enough people, turns out to be the most important single decision you can make, because the benefits to the whole system are lifelong. 6. The biggest single thing to heal. We've shown you enough proof of the whole system approach to make a bold statement. Mind and body are one. If only one thing is healed in your life, it should be the separation between mind and body. Right now, as most of us live our lives, the self we call me hasn't fully mastered the role of the healing self. The chief reason is a loss of wholeness. We have been taught to regard the body as separate from the mind, which is really only a belief. When you look in the mirror, what do you see? Without a second's thought, anyone would say, "My face." But in fact, your reflection is something you aren't simply looking at. You are reading it. You read indications of what mood you're in, whether you're feeling fresh or tired, how old you are, and what the years have imprinted upon you. We talked before about an invisible map that we all carry around in our minds, about how life and relationships work. But as a visible map, your face and your whole body symbolize the same things. As your story changes, so does the map. To quote a clever medical axiom, if you want to see what your thoughts were like yesterday, look at your body today. If you want to see what your body will be like tomorrow, look at your thoughts today. Holistic has become a staple term in the wellness movement. But at a certain level, it's easier to live in separation. You are able to detach yourself from what your body is doing. As a sad example, when presented with the possibility that a disease might have a mental component, some patients wail, "You mean I did this to myself?" Self-healing for them comes with an accusation that they are at fault. Yet, other people have taken the body-mind to extraordinary heights, and in each case, a new possibility is opened that applies to everyone. Extraordinary possibilities. What if you could wake up every morning for years at a time at precisely the same minute on the clock? This was the case with the pioneering American psychologist William James, although it seems to have been an unconscious ability. What if you could instantly make an allergy go away? Such a feat has been recorded with patients suffering from multiple personality disorder, where one personality has an allergy that vanishes when a different personality appears. In one case, a child would break out in hives while drinking orange juice as his allergic personality emerged at that moment. But he showed no symptoms if another personality was present. What if you could sit in a freezing ice cave overnight wearing only a thin silk robe? Such a feat has been observed among Tibetan Buddhist monks who have mastered a meditation known as Thumo, in which body temperature, which is normally involuntary, comes under conscious control. At one extreme, a Westerner who has been submitted to medical testing, Dutchman Wim Hof, performs feats of body temperature control, like hiking to a mountaintop in a blizzard, wearing only a pair of summer shorts, or sitting submerged up to his neck in ice-filled water for several hours. Hof has his own explanation of how he arrived at his accomplishments. "I said the autonomic nervous system will no longer be autonomic. The problem with this statement is that standard medical understanding holds that the autonomic nervous system cannot be affected voluntarily." A significant study from Holland, however, strongly challenges that understanding and comes down on the side of Hof. The study, published in 2014 in the Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences, provides evidence for voluntary activation of one activity linked to the autonomic nervous system, the immune response. Healthy volunteers were trained for 10 days in meditation, third eye meditation, breathing techniques, cyclic hyperventilation followed by breath retention, and exposure to cold, immersions in ice-cold water. The control group was not trained. Then both groups were injected with toxins from a strain of the bacteria Escherichia coli, commonly called E. coli. E. coli normally resides in the intestinal tract and is harmless. But there are pathogenic strains that cause food poisoning, for example. After receiving the toxin, the trained group followed their voluntary techniques, while the control group did nothing. Blood samples were taken, and they revealed that the trained group had a lower release of pro-inflammatory chemicals that the researchers connected to a profound increase in the hormone epinephrine, which is known to decrease inflammation. Besides showing that Wim Hof had grasped the link between his extraordinary physical control and the autonomic nervous system, the Dutch results could theoretically be used by sufferers of persistent inflammation, especially those with autoimmune diseases. As exotic as these examples may seem, almost anyone can successfully will a red spot to appear on the back of their hands or make their palms grow warm using simple biofeedback. In the age of wearables, medical inventors are seeking ways that we can monitor signs of potential disease or stress through a wrist-worn device that then allows us to return to a normal state of balance at will, again, using simple biofeedback. The big question is what a life built around the body-mind would be like, and whether it will create a quantum leap in well-being. We think it will, as it already has for the remarkable woman in the following account. Tao Story: Peace and Passion. One couldn't hope for a better example of someone who has lived a healing life than Tao. She has a striking physical presence with her almond skin and dark hair, being the child of a French father and an Indian mother. But it's her personal presence that's even more striking, a kind of smiling serenity all of us would wish for when we reach Tao's age, which is 99. She's also the world's oldest professional yoga teacher, as acknowledged in the Guinness Book of World Records. She still teaches 6 to 8 yoga classes a week in the New York City area. When asked what her definition of yoga is, Tao replies immediately, "Union, oneness." When asked if she ever plans to retire, she laughingly replies, "I will teach yoga as long as I can breathe." If you amass the facts of her life, it seems too unique and extraordinary to duplicate. Born Tao Porchun in 1918, she came from a prosperous family in Pondicherry, the French-colonized area of India on the southwest coast. Her mother died giving birth to Tao, and she was raised by her aunt and uncle. When she was 8, she walked into a room of the house to see a man sitting on the floor while visitors and family members touched his feet, the traditional sign of veneration in India. Tao speaks about all her experiences in a clear, articulate voice. "I was shooed from the room, and then one night my uncle woke me up early. 'We're going on a trip,' he whispered. 'Don't tell your aunt. She'll be worried.' I had no idea where my uncle was taking me, but as it turned out, I joined the first of 2 marches I made with Mahatma Gandhi. He was the man whose feet they were all touching." This singular event put Tao on a path she has followed her entire life, whose theme is peace. The casual sight of young yoga practitioners on the beach gave her an early interest in doing yoga herself, even though at the time, the 1920s, the practice was considered to be almost strictly for males. Tao grew up in a spiritual atmosphere, and under the guidance of spiritual luminaries like Sri Aurobindo, who was the most famous guru in that part of India at the time, and whose reputation spread worldwide, She developed her own conscious philosophy of life. It is essentially heart-centered, seeing